welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, June 7th, 2023. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. Starting on today's front page, our first article headline is University of Iowa Pursuing $250 Million Health Sciences Site. Project would continue the university's health science construction boom, by Vanessa Miller. Continuing its construction boom involving more than $1 billion in new and renovated facilities, University of Iowa Healthcare next week will seek Board of Regents approval to spend $249 million on a new 263,000-square-foot health sciences academic building. The new six-story academic facility, realizing another item on UIHC's 10-year modernization plan, unveiled last year, will house a trio of nationally esteemed departments central to the UI Health campus. Communication Sciences and Disorders, Health and Human Physiology, and Physical Therapy and Rehabilitation Science. The West Side Project, planned behind Slater Residence Hall, will encourage cross-department collaboration while also expanding the UI inventory of modern general assignment classrooms, according to Regent documents. All three programs support the training of Iowa's future healthcare workforce and have demand for program growth, which is not supported by their current facilities, according to the board request. All three departments currently sit in aged facilities which are not optimized to their current needs or projected growth and, for that reason, are slated to be either raised or repurposed. The Communication Sciences and Disorders Department, for example, will move from the 56-year-old Wendell Johnson Speech and Hearing Center, which must come down to make way for a new 842,000 gross square foot inpatient tower. Though administrators haven't released exact size and budget details for the tower, UIHC's five-year capital plan has it spending $620.9 million on the new north inpatient tower between 2024 and 2028. That doesn't include money already spent and to be spent after 2028 on the tower, which will nearly double the size of the 469,000-square-foot, $525.6 million hospital UIHC is building in North Liberty. The new tower also will dwarf a 507,000-square-foot UI Stead Family Children's Hospital that opened in 2017 and saw its price tag balloon from $270.8 million to $450 million. The UI Physical Therapy and Rehabilitation Sciences Department, once its new home is ready, will move out of the Medical Education Building, which will become the site of a future separate health sciences research facility a block north of the main hospital. The Health and Human Physiology Department will relocate from the fieldhouse, with its vacated space tapped for other fieldhouse occupants. Next week's UIHC ask to spend another $250 million expanding its health sciences operation comes 2 months after the Board of Regents in April granted UI permission to proceed with $185 million in healthcare and medicine-related projects, including a $37 million expansion of its emergency department. Other projects in the works include a $95 million two-floor addition to UIHC's existing inpatient tower, an $8 million conversion of its south wing for more beds, a $2.3 million ophthalmology simulation lab on parking ramp 4's lower level, and a $49 million expanded neonatal intensive care unit on the seventh floor of its children's hospital. To enable construction of its new patient tower, the university is building a $75 million west campus parking ramp and spending $1 million to raise the South Quadrangle Building and Price Alliance Center, which sit on the site of the proposed new Health Sciences Academic Building. Removing those two buildings this summer, and later the Speech and Hearing Center, is expected to save the university $11.5 million in deferred maintenance costs. Given the new academic building will house programs currently occupying buildings that need to come down, UI officials are characterizing it as an enabling project for the construction of the new UIHC inpatient bed tower, which will help UIHC meet its expected need for 1,272 inpatient beds by 2031, which is 424 more than it had in 2021. A construction timeline for the new academic building has work starting on the Communication Sciences and Disorders wing this summer and wrapping in the summer of 2025, after which work will begin for the other departments and classrooms, with final completion expected in summer 2026. UIHC plans to pay for the building with hospital revenue, investment income, and debt. Private philanthropy would also be pursued to support the project, according to Regent documents. Also on today's front page, lifetime of research links Gulf dead zone to fertilizer. Scientists forecast this year's hypoxic zone is smaller than average, bigger than last year. By Joy Mazur of the Columbia Missourian. Cocodrie, Louisiana. In the summer of 1985, Nancy Rabelais set sail on a research vessel into the Gulf of Mexico and into the scientific unknown. Back then, scientists knew little about wide expanses of low oxygen water called hypoxia that sometimes appeared in the Gulf and other bays and rivers. That summer, Rabelais' team was set on discovering how these areas connected to creatures that dwell on the bottom of the Gulf. While analyzing water and sediment samples miles off the coast, the team from the Louisiana University's Marine Consortium, LUMCON, and Louisiana State University, LSU, quickly discovered that hypoxia stretched from the Mississippi River to Texas and lasted for most of the summer. Later, they pinpointed the cause: increased amounts of nitrogen and phosphorus in the Gulf, largely due to runoff from farm fertilizer and other sources in the Mississippi River Basin. Rabelais' research put the Gulf of Mexico dead zone on the scientific map and into the nation's psyche, leading to the creation of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's Mississippi River Gulf of Mexico Hypoxia Task Force and a host of efforts to combat nutrient pollution, which EPA calls one of America's most widespread, costly, and challenging environmental problems. Over nearly four decades, Rabelais has become a giant in her field, testifying to Congress multiple times, mentoring countless students at LSU, and publishing roughly 160 studies. Now 73, Rabelais said she doesn't plan to go on the research cruises anymore due to her age and health issues, but she remains engaged in her work and is training the next generation. "I believe in doing research that can support the public good," she said. "This is one of those ways." Born in Wichita Falls, Texas, Rabelais grew up with a love for water. She was certified to scuba dive at the age of 19, a skill that would come in handy while replacing monitors 60 feet under the Gulf surface. She was fresh off a doctorate in zoology with a minor in marine science from the University of Texas at Austin when she took charge of LUMCON's first hypoxia research cruise in the Gulf of Mexico in 1985, directing a full-time crew on the 116-foot-long research vessel Pelican. "I just developed enormous respect for her, not only in terms of her commitment and intelligence, but her fortitude," said Don Bosch, the first executive director of LUMCON. The crew set out from Terrebonne Bay and traveled about 6 to 8 hours to reach the dead zone, where they took oxygen measurements and established stations. This network eventually grew from roughly 40 to 80 stations spanning the coast from Louisiana to Texas. Rabelais and her colleagues also dug into the history of nutrients, literally. By inserting tubes into mud from the bottom of the Gulf and slicing them up, they were able to date the different layers of sediment and identify amounts of carbon and nitrogen from decades earlier. That proved the Gulf had not always been low in oxygen. "We did all kinds of things to piece together the story and develop the long-term data set," Rabelais said. Over time, the crew grew to include professors, scientists, students, and volunteers from a variety of disciplines. One was fellow oceanographer Eugene Turner, now a professor at LSU. A mainstay in hypoxia research from the beginning, he also became Rabelais' partner, and they married in 1988. Together, they worked to detail the causes and effects of hypoxia in the Gulf. By 1998, Rabelais was testifying before congressional committees to tell legislators why they should be concerned about hypoxia. As a result, Congress decided that federal funds should be given each year to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration to mitigate hypoxia. "When we started out, she'd laugh at me. She'd say, 'Oh, you're going to write a paper and change policy,'" Turner said, "but that's what we do." Rabelais became executive director of LUMCON in 2005 and maintained the position until 2016. Her research has documented most of what we know now about Gulf hypoxia. From about May to September every year, the Gulf develops the largest hypoxic zone in the U.S. Hypoxic conditions occur when an area of water has less than 2 milligrams of oxygen per liter of water. It usually means the death or flight of most living organisms in the area. Hypoxia can occur naturally in water, but humans have worsened the problem since the 20th century. Nutrient runoff from farm fertilizer and other sources washes into rivers and streams, increasing nitrogen and phosphorus in waterways. Nutrients from states and provinces in the Mississippi River Basin wash into the watershed and into the Gulf in the spring and early summer. The fresh water with excess nutrients lies on top of the Gulf salt water and spurs algal blooms. The algae eventually die and sink into the salt water below, using up the oxygen supply. Matt Rota, Senior Policy Director for the advocacy group Healthy Gulf, said addressing nutrient pollution is important for everyone. The things that we're doing to cause the dead zone are also causing us to have less healthy soil and causing our drinking and recreational waters to become polluted, he said. The hypoxic monster stretched across about 3,275 square miles of the Gulf in 2022. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration announced Tuesday that it is forecasting the area will be 4,155 square miles this summer. While the 2023 forecast is smaller than the 5,364 square mile average over the 36-year history of dead zone measurements in the region, it is well above the Hypoxia Task Force's goal of shrinking the dead zone to 1,900 square miles or smaller by 2035. We're not on track, Rabelais said regarding the goal. I keep saying there's no social will. The zone is predicted to be smaller than the average area, mostly due to lower discharge from the Mississippi River. Since the 1950s, the amount of nitrogen in the Mississippi River watershed has tripled, and the amount of phosphorus has also increased, in part from fertilizer applied in Midwestern states. Congress exempted agriculture from the Clean Water Act of 1972, leaving responsibility for controlling nutrient pollution to individual states. This restricts the EPA's ability to limit nutrient runoff from non-point sources like farms. The result is multiple federal and state-funded efforts to reduce nutrients through voluntary programs for farmers, like rotating crops to enrich the soil naturally without fertilizer. But those efforts have not yet met goals to dramatically reduce the size of the dead zone. Some researchers and advocates argue the responsibility of reducing runoff should rest on the agriculture system rather than on individual farmers who often have little incentive to adopt voluntary changes. For Rabelais, persistence is the name of the game. She believes we shouldn't discount the role of the individual. She eats less meat and avoids ethanol fuel to lessen her personal impact. I try to maintain my optimism that good efforts can produce good results, she wrote in a 2021 reflection on her work. This story is part of The Price of Plenty, a special project investigating fertilizer from the University of Florida College of Journalism and Communications and the University of Missouri School of Journalism, supported by the Pulitzer Center's Nationwide Connected Coastlines Reporting Initiative and distributed by the Mississippi River Basin Ag and Water Desk. Moving on to local news from inside the paper. I See Man Accused of Lighting Fake Flowers on Fire, Throwing Them at Girlfriend, by Emily Anderson. An Iowa City man was arrested Monday on charges that, during an argument with his girlfriend of 8 years, he lit fake flowers on fire and threw them at her, according to a criminal complaint. Ray Del Palmer, 55, is charged with first-degree arson and domestic abuse assault. The flaming flowers caused minor burns on the woman's fingers and hair and then landed on the bed and started a fire, which was quickly put out, according to the complaint. First responders were called to the scene around 4:40 p.m. and Palmer left before police arrived. Two other people were in the apartment building on East Bloomington Street at the time of the fire, the complaint states. Palmer had his first appearance in court Tuesday and is being held in the Johnson County Jail on a $27,000 bond. A no-contact order has been filed on behalf of the woman. Source of Iowa fish kill a mystery for now. Unknown pollutant flowed into a creek that runs through Hampton, by Jared Strong of the Iowa Capital Dispatch. An unknown pollutant flowed from a stormwater sewer into a creek that runs through Hampton and killed a large number of fish last week, according to the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Some questions remain. The DNR has not been able to identify a source of the pollution, and the department is awaiting test results to identify the pollutant. We're kind of at a loss, said Jeremy Klatt, a DNR senior environmental specialist who investigated the situation. He did not have an estimate of how many fish had been killed, but said he saw substantial numbers of small fish and two northern pike. I think it did kill everything. An angler reported the dead fish in Squaw Creek on the east side of Hampton on Thursday morning. Klatt tracked the fish kill about 1.5 miles upstream to a stormwater outfall on the west side of town. Klatt noted Friday that fish were again swimming in the creek, which indicates a short-lived plume of contamination likely went into the creek and killed fish as it went downstream. The stormwater sewer connects to several business sites in the area, but it also connects to farm field tiling outside the town, Klatt said. He saw no obvious contamination from any of the businesses. There could have been a spill or something out there in a field, Klatt said. The contaminated water had a reddish tint but had no distinctive odor. Tests of the water, including for potential herbicides, are expected to be complete in about 2 weeks. The sewer collects stormwater runoff. There was some rainfall near Hampton on Tuesday and Wednesday, but it totaled less than 0.2 inches, according to National Weather Service data. Those who might know the source of the contamination can call the DNR's Mason City Field Office at 641-424-4073. Assault on former Hawkeye Bohannon draws probation. Former ISU football player convicted of assault receives deferred judgment, by Trish Mahaffey. A judge has sentenced a former Iowa State University football player convicted of assaulting former University of Iowa basketball player Jordan Bohannon outside a downtown bar in 2021 to 1 year of probation and granted him a deferred judgment. Nicholas Crone, 31, of Nashville, Tennessee, pleaded in March to assault causing bodily injury, a serious misdemeanor. He admitted to assaulting Bohannon outside D.C.'s bar in Iowa City on May 23, 2021. According to a criminal complaint, Bohannon and Crone were both at the bar, and after it closed, Bohannon and another person got into an argument outside. Crone punched Bohannon 3 times in the head, knocking him to the ground. Bohannon had a cut on his head from the assault. Bohannon's friends helped him leave, but later he was taken to a hospital for treatment. In the plea, Crone admitted he assaulted Bohannon intending to cause pain and without justification. Last Thursday, 6th Judicial Associate District Judge Jason Burns sentenced Crone in Johnson County District Court. The deferred judgment means Crone's record will be expunged if he doesn't have any violations during his 1 year probation. As part of his probation, Crone can't have any further law violations, must pay any civil penalty or victim restitution and court fees, serve 100 hours of community service, and complete all recommendations for mental health treatment. Bohannon filed a lawsuit against Crone for the assault in July 2021, but it was dismissed in January 2022 without prejudice by the court for failing to serve Crone with the suit in a timely manner. A new lawsuit was filed last month against Crone for brutally, unlawfully, and intentionally assaulting Bohannon. One killed in crash north of Marion, by Emily Anderson. One person was killed Tuesday morning in a crash at the intersection of County Home Road and North 10th Street, just north of Marion, according to a news release from the Linn County Sheriff's Office. The Sheriff's Office was called at 8:23 a.m. for a report of a serious crash. A semi-truck had been traveling west on County Home Road when it hit a 2008 Nissan Rogue that attempted to cross the intersection, heading north on North 10th Street. The Nissan was pushed into the yard of a vacant house at 2409 County Home Road. A passenger in the Nissan was pronounced dead at the scene, and the driver was taken to a hospital with serious injuries. The driver of the semi suffered minor injuries. The names of those involved in the crash have not been released, pending notification of families. The Linn County Sheriff's Office was assisted at the scene by the Marion Fire Department and Iowa Department of Public Safety Motor Vehicle Enforcement. The crash remains under investigation by the Sheriff's Office. Iowa teenager solicits hitman to kill 7-year-old, by the New York Daily News. An Iowa teenager is accused of soliciting a hitman to whack a 7-year-old child for reasons that are unclear. Police said an unidentified 17-year-old girl in Storm Lake, Iowa, contacted the farcical website rentahitman.com on Friday with information about her intended target, including the child's name and location, according to station KTIV. The suspect reportedly logged onto the site twice before authorities were notified she was shopping for a hitman. A police officer pretending to be a paid assassin contacted the suspect Friday afternoon after the website notified authorities of the murder-for-hire attempt. She was taken into custody that afternoon after law enforcement determined the teen was serious about having the child killed. After being interviewed and having her phone searched, the teen was reportedly charged with felony solicitation to commit murder. The target was never in actual danger or aware that someone was trying to put a price on her head. Rentahitman.com has been contacted many times by people who aren't in on the joke. A Pennsylvania woman was accused of using the site to put a hit on her ex-husband's new wife and that woman's 13-year-old daughter in December. In 2020, a Michigan woman was arrested after logging on to have her ex-husband killed in Tennessee. Police said she offered to pay $5,000 and travel expenses to an undercover cop who busted her instead. And in April, an Air National Guardsman was arrested after reaching out to the site to see if they were hiring contract killers. The site's operator, who goes by Guido Finelli, tweeted about the latest incident Monday. Rentahitman.com jokingly advertises itself as your point-and-click solution and promises it is 100% HIPAA compliant in accordance with the fictional Hitman Information Privacy and Protection Act of 1964. Step up and claim your $1 million prize, Iowa Lottery Please, by the Gazette Lee Des Moines Bureau. A $1 million lottery prize won in Ames remains unclaimed after 9 months. The Iowa Lottery is reminding players to double-check their tickets, as the prize will expire after September 6th, the last date when it can be claimed. 9 other prizes, ranging from $10,000 to $150,000, are also unclaimed in Iowa, the state lottery said. The $1 million winning Mega Millions ticket was purchased at the filling station Gateway Express at 2400 University Boulevard in Ames for the game's drawing on September 6, 2022, just after the Labor Day weekend, the Iowa Lottery said. The store earned a $10,000 bonus for selling the winning ticket. This is a real-world demonstration of why the Iowa Lottery reminds all players to always check their ticket results, Iowa Lottery CEO Matt Strawn said in a news release. The winners of the $1 million prize have until the close of business on September 6 to claim the prize at Iowa Lottery headquarters in Clive. Bird, Iowa, leads suit against California's trucking requirement. The Iowa Attorney General, Brenna Bird, is leading a coalition of 19 states in challenging federal regulators' decision to allow California to require truck manufacturers to sell an increasing number of zero-emission trucks. According to the Associated Press, under California's rule, manufacturers will have to sell a higher percentage of zero-emission vehicles starting in 2024. Depending on the class of truck, zero-emission ones will have to make up 40% to 75% of sales by 2035. The EPA and California have no right or legal justification to force truckers to follow their radical climate agenda, Bird said in a news release. Rather than support our hardworking truckers, President Biden continues to empty their wallets and force them to drive electric trucks for his radical climate change agenda. Iowa isn't going to take a back seat as the EPA and California try to regulate truckers out of business. We're pushing back. According to the Iowa AG's office, the other states joining the lawsuit include Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, Kansas, Kentucky, Indiana, Louisiana, Mississippi, Missouri, Montana, Nebraska, North Carolina, Oklahoma, Ohio, South Carolina, Utah, and West Virginia. Transgender advocates say Florida ruling helps for taking on Iowa law, but lawsuit challenging Iowa gender-affirming ban for minors hasn't been filed, by Tom Barton of the Gazette Des Moines Bureau. Transgender Iowans and LGBTQ and civil rights advocates praised a ruling Tuesday by a federal judge in Florida, temporarily blocking portions of a new Florida law that bans transgender minors from receiving puberty blockers, stating gender identity is real. The judge ruled that Florida had no legitimate state interest for denying patients treatment. What we've seen from federal courts over and over is these laws are unconstitutional and blatantly discriminatory, Keenan Crow, a lobbyist with LGBTQ activist group One Iowa, told the Gazette. It's the strongest worded ruling that we've seen thus far, Crow said. It really lays it out in no uncertain terms that banning treatment for minors ignores the benefits that many patients realize and the substantial risk posed by foregoing the treatments. I appreciated that the judge validates that gender identity is real in plain language, and anybody who tries to say different has their work ahead of them, Crow said. While the Florida ruling does not directly apply to Iowa, Crow said it helps set the groundwork for a future legal challenge to a similar ban signed into law in March by Iowa Republican Governor Kim Reynolds. There's no such thing as a ruling in a vacuum, Crow said. Judges in other courts are not oblivious to the legal rationale of other judges, and the totality of rulings we're getting and the legal consensus out of the federal court so far bodes well for a future challenge. Iowa Senate File 538 prohibits Iowa doctors from prescribing puberty blockers or hormone therapy to transgender children under the age of 18. It also prohibits any surgeries on minors if the practice is performed for the purpose of attempting to alter the appearance of or affirm the minor's perception of the minor's gender or sex, if that appearance or perception is inconsistent with the minor's sex. Doctors who violate the law would be subject to discipline from a state licensing board, and individuals could bring lawsuits against doctors who perform gender-affirming care. Teens receiving hormone therapy and other gender-affirming care had 6 months from the measure being signed into law March 22nd to discontinue treatments in Iowa. They can still seek treatment in other states, and the law does not prohibit doctors from referring their patients to out-of-state providers. A lawsuit challenging the Iowa law has not been filed. Activists and civil rights attorneys in the state say they are watching and waiting on the outcome of a U.S. Court of Appeals ruling over a similar ban in Arkansas before deciding about moving ahead here. A U.S. District Court judge issued a temporary injunction in August 2021, putting the August Arkansas law on hold pending resolution of the suit. A three-judge panel of the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, which includes Iowa, upheld the injunction in August 2022. Opponents note the new Iowa law conflicts with both state and federal civil rights protections. Gender identity was added as a protected class to the Iowa Civil Rights Act in 2007. Republican state lawmakers, though, have introduced bills, including this past legislative session, to remove gender identity as a class from the Iowa Civil Rights Act, stripping transgender Iowans of protections in the areas of housing, employment, education, public accommodations, and credit practices. The new Iowa law states, compliance with or enforcement or implementation of this section shall not constitute a violation of any provision of the Iowa Civil Rights Act. Republican supporters of the legislation have argued that minors aren't mature enough to fully comprehend the potential consequences of medically transitioning, even though providers require parental permission. Reynolds and Iowa GOP lawmakers also have said they do not believe the science is settled on the long-term impacts of gender-affirming care, citing other countries that have restricted the treatments. Critics contend the measure endangers the safety, welfare, and autonomy of transgender and gender-fluid youth, and adds to existing stigma and discrimination of LGBTQ youth who face higher rates of depression, anxiety, and suicide than their peers. Major medical groups in the United States, including the American Medical Association, American Psychological Association, and the American Academy of Pediatrics, say the treatments are safe, and the vast majority of studies show that the care leads to better mental health outcomes. With gender-affirming care, it should be parents, doctors, and mental health professionals who make these decisions, not politicians trying to score political points by throwing transgender kids under the bus, Mark Stringer, executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union in Iowa, said in a statement to the Gazette. See our bike ride tour's recent project improvements by the Gazette. The annual Ride the District's bike ride will be next weekend to help all residents get familiar with bicycle infrastructure in the community. The ride will start at 10 a.m. Saturday. Participants are encouraged to register for this free event on the city's website. Rain date is 10 a.m. Sunday. Weather-related updates will be posted on the website. The ride kicks off at Ellis Park near the pool to give riders a first-hand look at various bicycle facilities, according to a news release. The ride will feature upcoming and recent projects like the Cherokee Trail and Morgan Creek Trail. The 15.1-mile route will begin and end at Ellis Park, 2000 Ellis Boulevard Northwest, near the pool. Stop 1, Cherokee Trail Phase 2B Update, Wiley Boulevard Northwest and Cherokee Trail. Stop 2, Morgan Creek Park, Snacks, and Update on the Morgan Creek Trail. Stop 3, Cherokee Trail Phase 3 and Phase 4 Update. The City of Cedar Rapids has partnered with Linn County to complete a Trails and Bikeways plan, according to the city's website. This plan replaces the existing trails plan and map adopted in 2012. Since the plan was adopted, the city has made significant strides in trail and bikeway development, including doubling the miles of trails and adding more than 50 miles of new on-street bikeways. All ages and skill abilities are welcome to join the event. Juneteenth celebrations. Events range from live entertainment to films and discussions. Juneteenth, the oldest known celebration of the end of slavery in America, is being celebrated in many ways across the corridor. On its website, the African American Museum of Iowa explains, after the Emancipation Proclamation was issued on January 1, 1863, owners in many isolated areas kept word from the people they had enslaved so that they would not flee. On June 19, 1865, some of the last enslaved people in America were freed when the news at last reached Confederate Galveston, Texas. Since June 19, 1866, Juneteenth has been celebrated to honor the African Americans who built this nation. Cedar Rapids Opera presents its third free Juneteenth community event with the public world premiere of Charlie and the Wolf. This new opera by four-time Emmy-nominated composer Dave Ragland, Jr., and playwright Mary McCollum explores an imaginary meeting between jazz saxophonist Charlie Parker and classical composer Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. The story reminds viewers that we all play with the same notes, we just interpret them differently. Commissioned by Cedar Rapids Opera, Charlie and the Wolf will be presented at 1 p.m. June 18th at the Englert Theater in Iowa City and 1 p.m. June 19th at Whipple Auditorium at the Cedar Rapids Public Library. Admissions is free and reservations are not required. The show is best suited for ages 5 and up. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, June 7th, 2023 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Alberta Paulette Stanek, 79, of Cedar Rapids, died Saturday, June 3, 2023. Friends may visit with the family from 5 to 7 p.m. on Thursday at Tien Funeral Home and again on Friday after 9 a.m. Funeral service, 10 a.m. Friday at Tien Funeral Home by Penny Ackerman. Burial, Dunkard Cemetery, Toddville. Alberta was born on April 23, 1944 in Agency, the daughter of Floyd and Hazel Macbeth McConnell. She graduated from Ottumwa High School in 1962. On May 9, 1964, Alberta married Dale Stanek in Cedar Rapids. She worked for 30 years at Evergreen Packaging, retiring in 1999. Alberta was a doting grandma who loved to bake. She was a longtime volunteer for Linn County Republican Women, earning Volunteer of the Year in 2003. She was a regular shopper at Von Maur and collected Longaberger baskets and dishes. Alberta supported America Reads. Please consider donating your time to this organization by reaching out to your local library or school district to see how you can volunteer for this worthy cause. Online condolences can be left at tnfuneralhome.com. Donald Ray Montgomery of Vinton, 91, died Monday, June 5th at the Vinton Lutheran Home. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, June 7th at the Phillips Funeral Home in Vinton. Family graveside services will be held at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery on Thursday. Don was born on August 30, 1931, on the family farm in Harrison Township, Benton County, the son of Guy E. and Olive E. Ferguson Montgomery. On February 3, 1952, he was united in marriage to Elaine Weiss at Central Park Presbyterian Church in Cedar Rapids. Don worked for Pioneer Seed Company, retiring in 1996. Don enjoyed reading, yard work, and playing cards. Don and Elaine loved spending time at their summer home at Harper's Ferry on the Mississippi River, spending over 63 years at Taylor's Court boating and fishing. After retirement, they became snowbirds, spending 9 winters in Harlingen, Texas. Spending time with grandchildren and great-grandchildren and attending their activities was his greatest joy. Online condolences, phillipsfuneralhomes.com. Edmund Ed Leroy Bauer, 75, of Walker, Iowa, passed away on Monday, June 5, 2023, at Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids. A visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. on Thursday, June 8, at St. John Lutheran Church in Center Point. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. on Friday, June 9th at the church, where an additional visitation will be held 1 hour prior to service. Reverend Tom Van Hemmert will officiate. A burial will follow at Walker Cemetery in Walker. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion is assisting the family. Ed was born on May 12, 1948 in Independence, Iowa, the son of Maynard John and Dorothy Lavinia Fox Bauer. He was a 1966 graduate of Walker High School and went on to become a farmer after having worked on the farm since he was 8 years old. Ed served honorably in the United States Army during the Vietnam War. On June 26, 1968, Ed was united in marriage to Judith Elaine Bolton at St. John Lutheran Church in Center Point. In his earlier years, Ed was a former member of the Walker JCs. He enjoyed farming, socializing, and helping his son at Bauer Auto. He was a lifelong resident of Walker. Edmund will be greatly missed by all who knew and loved him. Please share a memory of Edmund at murdockfuneralhome.com. Roy Lee Kintz, Jr., 89, of Coralville, died Monday, June 5, 2023. Roy Lee Kintz was born in West Branch, Iowa, to Roy and Fern Kintz on February 10, 1934. The home they were living in at the time had been the childhood schoolhouse of Herbert Hoover until it was converted into an apartment. The schoolhouse was moved to the site of the museum and restored to its original state as a schoolhouse. Roy was selected to build the chimney in his former birthplace. Anyone is free to visit the birthplace of Roy Lee Kintz, which is also a National Historic Landmark. Roy graduated from West Branch High School in 1951. His career began as an apprentice in the Bricklayers Union in 1953. He served in the U.S. Army from 1955 to 1957. In 1958, he married Rosemarie Gromisch, and they were parents of two sons, John, Kathy Kintz, and Wayne, Wanda Kintz, of Coralville. His wife, Rosemarie Kintz, passed away in 2003. In 2004, Roy married Edna Nuri Kintz and was later divorced in 2014. They remained as best friends until his passing. Roy was a Gold Card member of the Bricklayers Union and worked on many area projects. He retired from Seedorf Masonry. Roy enjoyed traveling and gardening. The family requests that memorial donations be made to the American Lung Association and Washington, Iowa Hospice. Visitation will be at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids on Thursday, June 8th from 5 to 7 p.m. The funeral service will be held on Friday, June 9th at 10 a.m. at the funeral home, with committal at West Branch Cemetery thereafter. A live stream of the funeral service may be accessed on the funeral home website. Please share a memory of Roy at murdochfuneralhome.com. Felicia Kylie Tharp, 28, of Newhall, passed away on Sunday, June 4th from injuries suffered in a traffic accident near Cedar Rapids. Memorial services will be held at noon Friday, June 9th at Phillips Funeral Home in Blairstown. Interment will be held at Pleasant Hill Cemetery, Blairstown. Visitation from 10 a.m. until service time at the funeral home on Friday. Felicia was born November 16, 1994, in Salt Lake City, Utah, the daughter of Todd and Carrie Meyer Tharp, and graduated from Benton Community High School with a class of 2013. Felicia played basketball during high school and had worked as a CNA and as a daycare provider, but her most important job was a mother to her children. Online condolences, phillipsfuneralhomes.com. Marilyn J. Sweet, 90, of Cedar Rapids, died suddenly at home on Monday, June 5th, of natural causes. A visitation will be held at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories on Friday, June 9th at 10 a.m., followed by the funeral service at 11 a.m. Interment will be 2:30 p.m. at Garden Plain Cemetery in Whiteside County, Illinois. Marilyn was born November 6, 1932, in Sterling, Illinois, the daughter of James Dwight Sweet and Verda Mae McDonald Sweet. She grew up on a farm near Garden Plain, Illinois, and attended grade school at Garden Plain Country School. The family moved to Mount Hope, Kansas in 1944, where Marilyn completed high school in 1950. She attended Colorado Women's College for 2 years, then the University of Kansas, where she received her Bachelor of Science degree in 1954. Marilyn received a stipend from the National Science Foundation to attend Michigan State University, where she obtained her Master of General Science degree in 1961. Marilyn began her teaching career in 1954 and over the years taught elementary and junior high science at Kansas City, Kansas, Zion, Illinois, DeWitt, Iowa, and at McKinley and Franklin schools in Cedar Rapids, retiring in 1989. She was a highly regarded teacher who challenged her students to do their best. Marilyn loved nature and enjoyed camping and hiking, especially in the mountains of Colorado and Wyoming. Marilyn was close to her siblings and organized many successful family vacations. She was a longtime member of Westminster Presbyterian Church in Cedar Rapids. Memorials may be directed to Defenders of Wildlife, National Audubon Society, or the Sierra Club. Online condolences may be directed to the family at cedarmemorial.com. Scott Shoger, 43, of St. Louis, Missouri, passed away at home on Saturday, June 3rd. Funeral Mass, 10 a.m. on Friday, June 9th at St. Jude Catholic Church in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, with Reverend Nicholas March as celebrant. A vigil service will be held on Thursday, June 8th at 4 p.m. at TN Funeral Home. Those not attending the vigil service may visit with the family from 4:30 to 7 p.m. at the funeral home and again on Friday after 9 a.m. at the church. Burial in St. Joseph Cemetery. Scott was born September 23, 1979 in La Crosse, Wisconsin. He was a graduate of LaSalle High School, Simpson College, Duke University, and St. Louis University. He taught theology for 15 years in St. Louis Catholic schools. Scott was a member of St. Mark's Catholic Church in St. Louis. He coached his daughters in basketball and softball. He was an avid Green Bay Packers fan and attended at least one game every year. He liked playing cards and games with family. Scott's family loved him and was proud of all his accomplishments. In lieu of flowers, donations may be directed to the family. Online condolences may be left for the family at tnfuneralhome.com. Bonnie Jean Darrow Belichick, 81, of Oxford Junction, passed away peacefully on June 5, 2023, at the Monticello Nursing Center following a sudden illness. Born at home to Leonard Whitey and Berdina Brockholm Darrow on December 9, 1941, outside of Monticello, she graduated from Oxford Junction High School in 1960. She married Boyd King in 1960. They were later divorced. They had two children, Connie, Eugene Wood, and Richard Edelin King. On March 12, 1998, she married Ronald Balachek of Oxford Junction. She worked at Marie's Sweet Shop, Schultz Brothers, Collins Radio, and Goss Graphics for 25 years, retiring in 2001. There will be a private celebration of life. Condolences may be sent to Ronald Balachek, 2353 38th Street, Oxford Junction, 52323. In loving memory of Larry J. Dvorsky, LD, 71, of Marion, who passed on May 20, 2023 while on vacation in Florida. Larry will be remembered by his famous line of, well, there you go. He loved boating, fishing, hunting, auto races, traveling, and socializing. He had a huge following from his construction talents. A memorial visitation will be held on June 22nd at American Legion Post 298 from 4 to 8 p.m. A memorial fund will be set up for Larry. Gary Frederick Fred McKinley, 83, of Coral Springs, Florida, formerly of Walker, Iowa, died Saturday, June 3rd after a long illness. Funeral service 11 a.m. Saturday, June 10th at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Centerpoint. Visitation will begin 1 hour prior. Burial, Walker Cemetery, Walker, Iowa. Fred was born October 16, 1939, in Walker, the son of Clifford and Lola Lavelle McKinley. He married a second time to Shelley Robbins McKinley on August 26, 1984, in Bernardsville, New Jersey. At the age of 17, he ventured off the family farm to join the Army, where he was stationed in Germany. Upon returning home, he began his career in the shoe industry, working at Kinney Shoes. Fred would eventually be promoted to the corporate office in New York City, where he went from assistant buyer to vice president and executive buyer. He received Buyer of the Year awards year after year, leading to his biggest promotion yet as general manager of Susie's Casuals. He was well-liked and respected by his colleagues in NYC, and he was put in charge of the annual Christmas party because everyone knew he knew how to throw a party. Fred took over the company's overseas operations in 1993 and relocated to Hong Kong with his wife Shelley and youngest daughter Erica. After retiring early, they moved to Florida, where he enjoyed fishing, spending quality time with his family, mastering the art of barbecue, and always keeping the landscaping in his yard looking immaculate. Fred will be deeply missed by his friends and family. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions can be made to the Prostate Cancer Foundation. Please share a memory of Fred at murdochfuneralhome.com under obituaries. That concludes today's obituaries. Moving on today's editorial page, there is one letter to the editor. It is from John Humphrey of North Liberty, and its title is Property Tax Breaks, Not Worth the Loss of State Revenue. Governor Kim Reynolds said the state is cutting $100 million in taxes to help seniors and vets. When I read that a chunk of $100 million is coming my way, I had to check it out. I called the Johnson County Assessor's Office to find out what I would rake in for being over 65 and a homeowner. I am 78. I learned that I will get a $100 tax break this year and a $200 tax break next year. So I will save $8.34 a week this year and $16.70 the following years. This money will have little impact on my budget, but cutting $100 million from a state budget means some department somewhere in Iowa might be taking a hit. I would rather see the folks forced to work for food stamps get my money. It would help them much more than it will help my wife and I. I wouldn't deny a veteran any tax savings, but they deserve every penny. But how much money did it cost the state to give people over 65 who own homes $8.34 a week for 1 year? It just seems that poor folks could benefit much more than us older homeowners when you are giving out money to Iowans. I don't need a new pickleball racket. Give my share to a homeless guy in Des Moines for medical care, mental health care, and food. And that is a letter in today's Gazette from John Humphrey, North Liberty. Here is a column by Jennifer Rubin. A First Amendment victory. Republicans, right-wing judges, and MAGA activists have set out to trample on free speech and individual rights in the name of battling wokeism. But last week, U.S. District Judge Thomas L. Parker, appointed by President Donald Trump, stood up to the MAGA bullies in striking down the so-called drag queen ban, the Adult Entertainment Act, in Tennessee. Freedom of speech is not just about speech. It is also about the right to debate with fellow citizens on self-government, to discover the truth in the marketplace of ideas, to express one's identity, and to realize self-fulfillment in a free society. He continued, That freedom is of the first importance to many Americans, such that the United States Supreme Court has relaxed procedural requirements for citizens to vindicate their right to freedom of speech, while making it harder for the government to regulate it. And the Tennessee statute impermissibly tried to regulate free speech, he found. Parker ruled that the law was both unconstitutionally vague and substantially overbroad because of the prohibition on displays harmful to minors, whatever that means. The law fails to provide fair notice of what is prohibited, and it encourages discriminatory enforcement. Parker noted that the Supreme Court does not protect obscenity, but certainly does protect speech that is unpopular. Simply put, no majority of the Supreme Court has held that sexually explicit, but not obscene, speech receives less protection than political, artistic, or scientific speech. The AEA's regulation of adult-oriented performances that are harmful to minors under Section 3917901 does target protected speech, despite defendant claims to the contrary. In retort to Republicans seeking to rid libraries, classrooms, and performance venues of anything they find offensive, Parker wrote, "Whether some of us may like it or not, the Supreme Court has interpreted the First Amendment protecting speech that is indecent but not obscene." And Parker also found the law targets the viewpoint of gender identity, particularly those who wish to impersonate a gender that is different from the one with which they are born. This is prohibited, content-based, viewpoint-based regulation on speech. Simply because MAGA politicians want to write trans Americans out of existence does not make it constitutionally permissible. The court finds that the AEA's text discriminates against a certain viewpoint, imposes civil sanctions, and spans a virtually unlimited geographical area, Parker wrote. The AEA can criminalize, or at a minimum chill, the expressive conduct of those who wish to impersonate a gender that is different from the one with which they were born in Shelby County. Such speech is protected by the First Amendment. He concluded, "This statute, which is barely 2 pages long, reeks with constitutional maladies of vagueness and overbreadth fatal to statutes that regulate First Amendment rights. The virulence of the AEA's overbreadth chills a large amount of speech and calls for the strong medicine. Governors and lawmakers, who took an oath to uphold the Constitution, should know better." Jennifer Rubin is a Washington Post columnist. Moving on to sports, here is today's high school baseball article. "Bridgewater's quality start fuels Lynx" by K.J. Pilcher. Northland's Cale Bridgewater laughed at the notion he served as the team's Swiss Army knife. He dismissively said, "On some nights, he feels like the tool used to do various tasks." Lynx coach Travis Griffith relies on him to do a little of everything. Roam the outfield, toe the rubber, lead off the batting order, and spark the offense with his speed. "It's what we push here," Bridgewater said. "We do everything, and that's what coach has asked me to do for the team, and that's what I'm doing, just going out and giving my best. Everybody on our team is this way. Do whatever he tells us to do. You'll do it." Bridgewater tossed a gem with the Lynx short on pitchers and in desperate need for him to eat up innings. He went 6 1/3 innings and propelled Class 1A 6th-ranked North Lynn to an 8-3 prep baseball victory over 2A No. 7 Cascade on Tuesday at Mount Mercy's Plaster Athletic Complex. Bridgewater improved to 3-0 this season, allowing just 2 earned runs and 7 hits with 7 strikeouts. Mason Becken recorded the last 2 in relief. "The two-seam fastball was hitting good and just locating pitches," said Bridgewater, who leads the team with 20 1/3 innings pitched. Griffith said recent injuries to starters Corbin Woods and Levi Benesch left the Lynx shorthanded for the ranked matchup and forced 3 eighth graders into the starting. He went to experienced players like Bridgewater and Becken to lead the way. Bridgewater helped spark the Lynx offensively. He led off the 4-run first with an infield single, moved to second on a walk to Ben Wheatley, and scored on Becken's double. Cale Benesch added an RBI groundout. Cole Griffith executed a squeeze to bring in Beckham and Jake Van Etten closed the early rally with an RBI single. Bridgewater finished 2 for 4 with a run. He leads the Lynx with 21 hits and 18 runs after the win over the Cougars. Cascade trimmed the deficit to 4-3 after the fourth inning. Jack Menster tripled to drive in Cass Hoffman and scored on a Cade Roush sacrifice fly in the 2-run third. In the fourth, Mason Otting reached on a drop third strike, advancing to a third on a wild pitch and balk. Jace Reinke followed with a 2-out RBI single. North Lynn responded when Benesch doubled to score Becken. Courtesy runner Nolan Woods scored on a balk to make it 6-3. The Lynx added insurance runs in the seventh, receiving an RBI triple from the younger Griffith and another Van Etten run-scoring base hit. Van Etten led the way with 3 hits and matched Benesch and Griffith with 2 RBIs. And now girls softball. Beck delivers dominance in 5. Lions pitcher hurls perfect game in 12-0 win over Washington by Jeff Linder. Cedar Rapids Washington is better, without a doubt, but nothing is better than perfect. Jordan Beck pitched a 5-inning perfect game, and Class 4A 4th-ranked Linmar handled Washington 12-0 in the first game of a Mississippi Valley Conference softball doubleheader last night at Franklin Field. "I was good, loose, and fresh," said Beck, a senior who will pitch at Indian Hills Community College next season. "I just tried to get it in there. I had the defense to back me up." Beck, 3-0, struck out 7, and the Lions, 7-3 overall, 6-1 MVC, scored in all 5 innings. Linmar tallied 3 in both of the first 2 innings, 2 apiece in the next 3. The Lions got their 3 first-inning runs without the benefit of a hit. After a pair of walks, Emily Caranda knocked in a run with a ground out, then Grace McCarty plated another with a sacrifice fly. McCarty drove in 3 runs. Caranda scored twice and drove in 2 more. Washington, 2-6-2-3, is a growing program, and though the Warriors committed 5 errors, they made most of the routine plays and pulled off a double play. The Warriors were aggressive at the plate, and Beck used that to her benefit. "The rise ball inside, mostly, was how she earned the majority of her strikeouts," she said. The second game was played after press time. High school baseball. Solon rebounds to earn split. Steinbrück with 3 RBIs in last 2 innings to help Solon pull away from Wolves. By K.J. Pilcher. Solon coach Keith McSweeney got a glimpse of his team's potential. The Spartans demonstrated what they can accomplish with strong pitching, solid defense, timely hitting, and limited mistakes. Solon went from routed to righting the ship, rebounding from a 13-3 loss in 5 innings in the opener to beating Class 3A No. 6 Marion 7-5 in the nightcap of a doubleheader split Monday night at Marion. "The second game was a good baseball game," McSweeney said. "When our guys play like that, we feel we can compete with teams of Marion's caliber. Hopefully we can get there by the end of the year ourselves. We think we're on our way." Solon led throughout Game 2 thanks to a specific formula. The top of the order set the table and the middle of the order feasted. Leadoff batter Blake Timmons, Brett White, and Gehrig Turner, and his courtesy runner Nash Kotar, accounted for all 7 runs. Timmons was plumped to lead off the game, and White followed with a base hit. Nolan Segrin increased his team high to 20 RBIs with a 2-run single for a 2-0 lead in the first. The Spartans were able to pull away late with a 2-run fifth and 3 more in the sixth. Vince Steinbrück provided 3 RBIs in those 2 innings, including a run-scoring single to score White in the fifth. He also drove the game-winning run with a 2-run single after Turner hit an RBI double. "The middle and back half of our order played well," McSweeney said. "They moved runners. I thought we put pressure on them on the bases." Solon also received a quality start from sophomore right-hander Jackson Link. He has served as a reliever for the Spartans this season until Monday. Link scattered 10 hits, allowing 5 runs to a Marion offense that entered Monday averaging more than 8 runs a game and scored 10 or more in 5 of the previous 6 games. "Link gave us a great start," McSweeney said. "This was his first of the year. He's given us some good innings this year in relief. He's kind of a utility guy at first base, catcher, DH, and obviously pitcher. He did a really nice job." Garza's goals. Iowa's 2021 National Player of the Year hopes for a second season with the Minnesota Timberwolves and wants to be a Bosnian Olympian. Luke Garza had doubts a year ago. "When I was cut by the Detroit Pistons last July, I lost a little belief in myself," said the 2021 National Men's Basketball Player of the Year at Iowa. Doubt started creeping in. "Am I an NBA player? This year I know I'm an NBA player." It will be at least a few more weeks before Garza has resolution on where he'll play next season, but it will be somewhere in the NBA. When the Minnesota Timberwolves were shorthanded for a stretch in February, the 6'11 Garza averaged 20.3 points in 18.3 minutes over a 3-game stretch, capped by a 25-point game at Utah. Garza is a restricted free agent. On June 29th, the Timberwolves must tender him a qualifying offer if they want him back. Then, other teams would have the opportunity to match or top the offer. But you don't have to read between any lines to know he wants to return to Minnesota. He found a fit there after being a second-round draft pick of the Detroit Pistons in 2021 and shuttling between the Pistons and their G League affiliate. Detroit waived him after the season. Garza went to the NBA Summer League with the Portland Trail Blazers, but wasn't signed by them. Minnesota did sign him last August 22nd with no guarantees other than a training camp roster spot. The Wolves converted him to a two-way contract in October and got a full season of seeing what he could do. He played 28 games for Minnesota, averaging 6.5 points. He was sent to the Wolves G League team in Des Moines on occasion. There, he played 9 games and averaged a whopping 29.8 points and 9.2 rebounds. He scored 47 points and had 15 rebounds in his final game with the Iowa Wolves, perhaps a permanent farewell to the developmental league. "I gained a lot of confidence to be able to do that," Garza said. "I wanted to show I could dominate in the G League and was able to do so. I personally feel I found a home in Minnesota. I love playing for Coach Chris Finch. It's a great system for what I bring to the table. I see room for improvement and potential." And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, June 7th, 2023. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.